My name is Chris Mann. I'm with Wing Commander S. Duke. We're in Oak Bay, and the date today is 24 August 1978. I was wondering, Mr. Duke, if you could tell us a bit about your family background, as far as where you were born, your early education, that type of thing.
Well, I was born in Ceylon.
Sri Lanka now.
My father was a doctor. And he also was one of the originators of growing rubber in Ceylon.
No kidding.
I had three sisters and two brothers. And in 1906, my father retired from his doctoring, although he still owned rubber estates in Ceylon.
What year were you born, sir?
1896. I was born October 3rd, 1896. Then we all, the whole family, went to England, and I went to school in Bath, in Somersetshire, at a school called Monkton Combe. And then in 1912, my father decided that he'd come out to Canada. He had the free run of Ceylon as a doctor, and he felt a bit confined in England. And while we were schooling, my brothers and my sisters and myself, we lived at a place called Bromley in Kent. He used to go to London two or three times a week, and he'd operate at the Children's Hospital in Great Ormond Street in a gratis kind of way, I think. And anyway, we came out to Canada, and my father was rather taken with the Niagara Peninsula. But somebody there said to him, well, before you settle here, why not go out and have a look at Victoria? So he and my mother came out here and looked at Victoria and decided that they'd really like to live here more than Niagara Peninsula. So he got an architect here and ordered the building of a house. This is right out North Quadra Street, which he figured was the most healthy part of Victoria. And that was in 1911, I think it was, he came out. And in 1912, the whole family came out. We all came out here to Victoria. And I wanted to go to McGill, so I went to university school for a term in order to do the McGill matric. And
well, what were your first impressions of Victoria in 1912?
Well, we lived out at the far end of Quadra Street. We had no car, and we were to rely on streetcars to get out there. And this was quite a walk from the end of the streetcar line up to our house. So the streetcar used to run out Douglas Street, and we had to walk up Cloverdale Avenue. And then to go to church, we used to do every Sunday. My family were great church people. We'd go to the Anglican Church, St. Luke's, at Cedar Hill. And there we would walk across the fields to the church at Cedar Hill.
Did you get downtown at all very much yourself?
No, not very much at that time, but a little later on I wanted to do something, and I went into the Merchants Bank of Canada, which was taken over later by the Bank of Montreal. Mm-hmm. And it was exactly where the main branch of the Bank of Montreal is today, on the corner of Douglas and Yates. I don't know whether you know that. And I got the noble sum of $25 a month in the bank.
Would this be what, 13 or 14,
or 1913? This would be 1913, I suppose it would be. And there was one girl only in the office, and she was the accountant's secretary. She was, the rest were all men, and most of them were Englishmen who were 90% unmarried, and they, I think, had a very good time. Off times, they played cricket and rugby football, and they lived in, many of them would band up together, six or seven or eight of them, and take a house in Fowl Bay or somewhere, and they'd have a Chinaman cook that would do for them. Well, then war broke out, and they just disappeared like that. They all joined up in something or other. And I remember going to the manager, a man named Fraser, a very fine man too, and I said, well, I'm going to leave now because I'm going to the war. He said, oh, don't do that. Why go to the war? Be over in no time. And, well, I said, anyway, I'm going to leave, so I joined the 88th.
Yeah. He's the leaders.
Yes.
And this battalion was a reserve militia.
Yes.
Battalion in Victoria. And your colonel then was, did you call him?
Cullen.
Colonel Cullen.
Yes.
When you joined the Fusiliers, now did you just go to the and sign the book, or how did you go about this? You didn't go to a Canadian Army recruiting or anything. You went specifically to this battalion. Is that correct?
Yes, specifically. I think that my family had known this Colonel Cullen before. You see, and actually he was the architect of the house that my father built here. And that's how we knew him, because my family had had an introduction to an Archdeacon Collison, who was the vicar of St. Luke's Church at Cedar Hill. And the Reverend Collison, Archdeacon Collison, introduced my father to Rouse Cullen as an architect, you see, building a house. Well, then when the war broke out, I think I went to Cullen, and he said, well, I'll give you, I recommend you for a commission in the 88th Regiment, which I got then.
So you made a second lieutenant then?
Second lieutenant, yes. No, well, a lieutenant, because there weren't second lieutenants in the Canadian set up in those days.
You were a full lieutenant.
Yes.
You were the full lieutenant in the 88th Fusiliers of Victoria.
Yes.
What was happening here? What type of uniform did they give you in this type of thing, messing conditions?
Well, you bought your own uniform.
As an officer.
Yes. And there was a firm here on Yates Street, Lang, L-A-N-G-E, Lang and Brown, who were very busy, must have made a lot of money, because they were very good and very quick tailoring, and they made uniforms for dozens and dozens of people, the regular uniform that you see in that picture.
Yes, I noticed in the picture you have of the 88 that the fellows were dressed very well. There wasn't a shortage in that sense, because of these whole officers.
So. Yes.
Because you had to buy your own, these guys in town were willing to provide. What about barracks? I think there's a phone or a bell ringing. turn back, tape recorders back on, sir. What about barracks? Did they provide you, or did you stay at home, or what?
We lived in the Willows campground, which had been the exhibition grounds, and there were several big buildings there in which the men lived. We, as officers, had tents in which we were housed, generally two officers to a tent, in the ordinary bell tent.
Mm-hmm.
And the men mess room was in one of the big Willows buildings, where they had their meals.
What was the food like? Very good at all?
Or? Yes, it was good. Very good.
How about the pay? Did the pay compare with your salary in the bank?
Oh, the pay was much better.
It was better?
Pay was good, yes. Well, the salary in the bank was nothing, as I say, $25 a month, but the salary in the bank, even for people who'd been in the bank some long time, the salary was very poor, really.
Just the social prestige of the job in the bank, is that part of it, or?
I suppose. Yes, I suppose.
Yeah. Did you have any specific ambitions or goals when you first joined the Fusiliers? Did you anticipate becoming a general or something like this?
No, I had, prior to the war breaking out, I had two things that I would like. One, I wanted to join the Royal Northwest Mounted Police, as it was then, or the Royal Flying Corps. But opportunities weren't ready-made, as it were, for either of those. However, the war breaking out gave me a chance to go to the Royal Flying Corps.
I always wanted to be in the flying corps. Though.
Yes, I always wanted to fly.
Very good. What about entertainment and sports or things like this? While you were in Victoria, did you organize tournaments and things? Or?
Well, I used to play tennis and used to play rugby, English rugby here.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of old country boys here who were keen rugby players. Like oneself, they'd come out from school in England and they were in the banks or were BC land surveyors or jobs of that nature. So there's a lot of good cricket and there was a lot of good rugby here.
You're a very British regiment, I take it, is that correct?
Well, yes, I would say so.
Hmm. When did you know you were going to go overseas? When was the unit activated? All at all?
Well, I would say about a year before we did go, that would be, or even before that, perhaps a year and a half before we went, which was May 1916, that we left Victoria to go overseas as a unit.
To mark time in Victoria, you a lot of drill? Or?
Oh, yes, we were training all the time.
Well, what did training consist of?
Well, route marches as much as anything. And at the rifle range, which was, you know where Clover Point is now? Well, that used to be the rifle range.
Oh, no kidding.
At Clover Point. And it was 1,000 yards was the longest range, which is quite a long
quite a
range.
Distance, yeah.
And down, and there'd be the 1,000-yard mark, and then the 500-yard mark, and so on down. And we'd fire into the butts, which is the end of where Clover Point comes round. and the 1,000-yard mark was along, that's about where Cook Street runs into the Dallas Road.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. When you decided to go overseas, were you still a lieutenant at this point, or you've been?
Oh yes.
You were still a lieutenant when you went to go overseas. How did you make your way over? Go across Canada by train, or?
Yes, the whole battalion went across on the CPR boat, the Princess Charlotte, went across to Vancouver, and there were two trains there in which we left Vancouver, went across to Halifax, and we boarded the Olympic was a ship, the White Star Line boat, and we used to have drill every day on board against submarines, you see.
Oh, yeah.
Fire drill and everything.
Oh, drill, etc.
Yes, that's true.
What were the conditions like on board? Were they crowded?
Yes, because there were 10,000 people on board, 10,000 troops, which would have been a great kill for the Germans if they could have got the one ship like that. And the men, when I talk of the men, that the rank and file, see, they all slept in hammocks down below, from deck after deck down. We had, as officers, there would be two to a cabin, and we were spread out through the ship, and it was a nice comfortable trip over. We got to Liverpool, and from Liverpool we went by train directly down to camp in Kent. And I think it had rained for a month before we got there, and it rained for another month after we were there, and we were all in tents there, and the mud was just...
Oh, no.
It was pretty terrible.
Right.
Well, then, after being there a little time, see, I went, as I mentioned to you before, to the Flying Corps.
Well, wasn't the 88th, you were also saying that the 88th was not going to go over as a battalion.
It was split up, yes.
It would be split up for relief and...
That's right. They'd reinforce other Canadian battalions which were already in France.
Well, how did you feel about that?
Everybody was very sad about that because, we all wanted to go as a unit.
A year and a half of training and being prepared.
Yes, and didn't want to go to other units, as it were. But you couldn't help it. That was
the order of the day.
Yes, that was the order of the day.
The conditions of this camp in Kent were pretty grim, I gather. Tents in the rain and the mud. How about food and clothing and for the men and things? Were they...
Well, the conditions were a bit grim there, there's no doubt about it. When we got out of the train that we'd embarked in Liverpool, in the train, we had a couple of miles to march to get to the camp where we were. Otterpool was the name of the place. And it was raining, and we marched there, and we were going to be allotted this field to stay in, or this camp. And we got there, and everybody was thankful to get there at last, and it was sort of let down. We wanted something to eat. And some of the camp staff came down. They said, well, you're in the wrong place, another mile on.
No.
Well, that extra mile was just about enough to cause a mutiny.
Oh.
However, we had to do that, and we had to go on. We went on another mile.
Were the tents pitched, or did you have to pitch your own tent?
No, they were pitched, yes.
Small blessings, though, eh?
Yes.
Oh, that must have just been awful.
And then the cooks followed, you see, and they had stew, and so we had some pretty good stew to eat. And, but
you heard that, if I got this correct, then that you were told, your officer, your colonel, and everyone was told that the unit was not going to go over as a unit, and that you were to reinforce. But yet you were saying that the Royal Flying Corps was sustaining quite heavy losses at this time, and that anyone wishing or anyone applying to the Flying Corps would get an automatic deferral, I guess, or would be sent
yes.
What exactly is all this?
Well, his application couldn't be suppressed. It had to be forwarded. In other words, I applied to go to the Flying Corps, and my colonel or the brigade commander couldn't not forward it on.
I see. Well, this is almost a wish come true for you, in that you wanted either into the Mounties
yes.
or a Flying Corps, and here's an opportunity. You didn't think twice about it, I gather.
Oh, yes. Yes. No, I was all for going.
You were all for going. You were accepted by the Flying Corps.
Yes, I...
And then what were the procedures here? Did you have to go for an interview, pass certain tests, physicals, or what exactly?
Yes, well, you had to go up to the headquarters of the Flying Corps in London, and you were interviewed there by Flying Corps officials, senior officers of the Flying Corps, and there were five of them sitting behind the table, and you would have to stand up in front of them, you see, and they'd ask you all sorts of questions about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose they wanted to find out whether you were likely to be a diabetic or something like this, or then you had to pass medical exams, particularly for your eyesight, for color vision and things like that. After you've gone through all these medicals, you were then sent, as I say, to Oxford to learn the theory of flight.
King's College? Or?
No, it was Queen's College,
Queen's
Oxford.
College.
Yeah.
Queen's College, Oxford. And this is what, late
1916.
You'd be given, at Oxford, you'd be given, what, the theory of flight and ground instruction? And
yes.
And how long did this last for?
Well, ordinarily, it would last for probably, I would say perhaps a couple of months, but then they asked for volunteers then to go as aerial gunners. And so I was there only 3 weeks to a month.
And you still retained your commission, is that correct?
Oh, yes. And I was paid by Canadians. I was
got Canadian wages.
Yes, and I was just attached to the Flying Corps. I wasn't transferred at all,
mm-hmm.
which made quite a difference to be paid by Canadians.
Yes, I would imagine.
Oh, yes.
Now, this aerial gunner business, so you were willing to volunteer for this aerial gunner on the condition that they would bring you back for your pilot training.
That's right, yes.
Well, for aerial gunner training, you went somewhere else. Where
yeah,
we
went to Hythe in Kent, which is a gunnery school, and they had there the theory of Lewis guns and Vickers guns, and you had to learn all about stoppages and how to clear stoppages in the guns, because they were subject to stoppages. Then you'd go up, a pilot would pilot you in a Vickers push-up plane, the Vickers gun butts, they were called. It was had the engine in the rear, and you were sitting in the nacelle, and they had on the ground marked out what was known as a petty Boche, which was a white silhouette of a plane. And you dive on this, you see, firing your gun and you could see where the tracer bullets were going, seeing how...
You had both a Vickers and a Lewis, or just Vickers?
No, just a Lewis.
You had a Lewis gun?
Yes, because you could move it around, see, with a Vickers...
Water-cooled,
and it was a set gun.
Yes.
You didn't move it about at all.
How long would this training last for?
Well, I think we were there about a month. And then, after that, I was posted to this squadron in Norfolk at a place called Narborough that was forming prior to going over to...
A new squadron was being formed.
A new squadron, yes.
This is 35 squadron?
35, yes.
But the 35 Squadron, Royal Flying Corps, British Expeditionary Force,
right? That's right, yeah.
Okay. So you're going to France, and this would be what, 1917 or late 16 still?
I think it was February 17.
February 17.
Yes.
And this squadron was going to be in cooperation with a cavalry unit, is that
right? Yeah, with the cavalry brigade there was a... The Hussars and the Lancers, and there were Indian cavalry regiments, and they were all in a brigade. And we would go over the lines and spot also for guns, too. We had to learn Morse code.
We had wireless in the plane at this time.
Yes,
too.
Yes. And also they had flip-flap, that... panels on the ground that you could pull the panel this way, which would show white, you see. It was like a Venetian blind, really, mm-hmm. on a big scale, you see. And you could signal from the ground to the plane. So that you had to know Morse code to...
Oh. The so they would signal from the ground up to you?
Up to you, yes, by pulling the thing, you see, dot, dash, and so...
Now, the pilot, what planes would you have here?
What kind of aircraft? These were
Armstrong Whitworths.
Yes, they had 160 horsepower Beardmore engines, and they were good, reliable engines. Before we went over, we used to go up to Newcastle where they were being built. And we'd fetch them from Newcastle, bring them down to the aerodrome at Narborough. And we had had some trouble with them catching fire.
Really?
Yes. They were a brand new plane, you see. And we'd fly them 500 feet above the ground, circle the aerodrome, and when they caught fire, come down quickly and land, and mechanics would rush to them to find out something to do with the carburetor.
Oh,
and nobody worried much about it, but, but you didn't want it to occur 10,000 feet.
Indeed. Well, no, you could be a torch at that.
Yes.
Oh, my. On the guns now, I know, like, with the fighter aircraft, they had an oil and a cam and a special system so that when the propeller was vertical, it would fire straight out. But this didn't affect you at all. Is that correct?
No, because you were in the rear seat
mm-hmm.
with your gun on a gun mount, you see, that
yes.
you could move the gun around and about. But take a Bristol fighter plane, which was a two-seater fighter,
mm-hmm.
the pilot had a Vickers gun, and it fired through the propeller by means of what was known as a Constantinescu gear.
Gear, that's what I was trying to get at. Yes.
It was a Romanian invention, and it tripped the gun so that if the blade was in the way, the gun couldn't fire. And that's really what it amounted to.
You didn't have to worry about this business at the back.
No.
You had your Lewis gun.
That's right.
How many rounds of ammunition would you pack in it?
Well, the average drum for the ground Lewis gun was 45 rounds, but for the aerial Lewis gun, which was just the same gun, you had drums of 90 rounds.
Hmm. 90 rounds. How many drums would you pack?
Well, you'd have four drums.
Plus
the one on the gun. On the gun.
Did you pack any small carry bombs or anything?
Yes. Not in that squadron, 35 squadron. Later, when I went back to England to learn to fly, I then went out in a single-seater fighter squadron, and there we carried four 20-pound Cooper bombs, which we just throw over like
lob over the side.
Yeah.
35 squadron, whereabouts were you stationed in France?
Villers Bretonneux was one place that we were. That was south of Amiens. And I think a place named Savvy. I'd have to look up in my
Before we get into the air, what type of officer's mess or regimental, well, it wouldn't be a regiment, but your squadron, 35 squadron, Royal Flying Corps, what type of mess facilities did you have in France? Was it palatial at all, or?
Oh, no, it wasn't palatial. No, it was, I don't remember 35 squadron as well as I remember 84 squadron, with which I was as a fighter pilot, you see.
Okay.
35 squadron, I wasn't so active in that as an aerial gunner, as it were. 84 squadron was a fighter squadron, and possibly one of the best fighter squadrons in France.
Well, getting into the air then, you were, what, 9 months with these, or how many months?
Yes, I must have been about 9 months in 35 squadron in France before I got back for training.
For pilot training.
Yeah.
What was it like being a cavalry cooperation?
Well, there wasn't an awful lot doing because the cavalry just weren't used much. And it was a question of waiting and waiting for a breakthrough.
Did you come into contact with the enemy at all at this point?
Oh, yes. Oh, we would. Oh, yes. We'd be attacked very often by enemy fighters. But we were a much slower machine, this Armstrong Whitworth. It was a clumsy type of machine, but it was purely for observation purposes.
So you just fire your guns at these fighters? Or?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
What was the casualty rate like?
Well, it wasn't very very severe at all. I have some photographs of the of members of the squadron and the plane that I can show you.
Oh, you stayed with these people with 35 Squadron for 9 months as the rear gunner.
Yeah.
And then the fellows that volunteered with you, as you were saying before, not too many have survived.
No.
Do you all have any idea how many?
Well, I think of the 30, probably no more than 5 went back for training.
Gee, that's not very many.
No.
How did you feel being a gunner when, in fact, you wanted to fly? Did that not bother you?
Oh, no.
In front, or?
No, you were always looking forward to the time when you get your pilot training and go back.
Did the pilot ever let you have a go at it up front before you got back, or?
No, because you couldn't get at it, you see. I mean, he was sitting in front with the controls. There was no dual control about it.
You couldn't get up there, eh?
Oh, you couldn't, no.
Well, did you have an advantage by your time in the airplane for when you went back on skills of flying or theories?
Oh, yes. Well, you I think it was a great advantage having had air experience. It was a great advantage when you were learning to fly yourself, solo.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite a thing there. And then was a great advantage, too, when you went to France to a fighter squadron, to be able to recognize an enemy plane in the distance. That's the thing. That
yes.
is the greatest thing in the world.
What did you think of the German planes and the German pilots?
Well, they were the planes at one time would be inferior to ours, and then they'd bring out a new one, and it went
back and forth,
yes.
What about the pilots? There's a lot of conception now that there was a lot of chivalry, mutual respect.
Oh, there was. Yes, there was. I know that towards the end of the war, see, we didn't have parachutes.
Yes.
But all the balloon people had parachutes, those in the observation balloon. Now, why we didn't, I don't know, but the top officials in the Air Ministry, I think, had some idea that we might abandon the plane too often if we had a parachute jump out.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen people jump out time and again, different plane on fire. See, with just hoping their leather flying coat, might ease their way down. They'd rather jump out than be burnt alive in the plane, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that happen quite often.
Well, how do you feel about that? Doesn't that bother you quite?
No, you took that in your stride.
All part of the
yes.
Part of the training. Oh, you went back to where? No, back to Oxford, Queen's College, to take your flying training then?
No, I went to Reading, and we had to take a course of engines. We were billeted in a house in Reading.
This would be, what, 1917 now?
Yes, the end of 1617. It was a place, I think, it was, if I remember, you know, it was a long time ago.
No, I know, sir. I'm sorry if I keep pressing you for days.
Well, I think there was a place there called Wantage Hall. And it was there that we did, again, theory of flight. And I remember there was a professor, somebody or other, who would lecture us in the mornings, and in the afternoons we would go into internal combustion engines, take them right down and build them up again and learn all about engines.
Was there problems of breaking engines at this time, poor quality engines and engines seizing up in the air?
Well, yes, you see, there were different types of engines. There was the radial engine and the rotary engine. And you probably know the difference between rotary and a radial engine.
The rotary ran around or something, didn't it?
The rotary engine, the whole thing would go around, The pistons would be set, but the cylinders would go around the pistons, and there was no carburetor to them at all, and there was no oil sump, you know, like the ordinary engine where you have your oil in the base.
Bottom, yes.
There was no sump, so the gas and the oil would go in through the center of the shaft together to each cylinder, you see, and would go out then, be used and go out. Quite wasteful, you might say. But then they took up very little room.
Mm-hmm.
A rotary wouldn't be wider than that, you see, but whereas the stationary engine, like a Rolls, would be so much
bigger and heavier.
Well, anyway, we'd had to learn all about these engines, and you really became quite knowledgeable on engines, which was a good thing. But what you were told was that at the end of the 6 weeks course, there was an examination, and if you didn't pass the examination, you'd have to go back to the infantry. And nobody wanted that. And so everybody worked really hard, particularly when you were told, when we were all told, that during the examination, the desks were put about 6 feet apart from each other, you see, like this table, the next one would be. And you couldn't take in any blotting paper with you, with any notes on it or anything like that.
It was a real test, a real exam.
Yes, and as I say, if you didn't pass, back to the infantry.
Before we get there, you mentioned back to the infantry. No one wanted to go into the infantry. What was your impression of what was going on the ground, the heavy losses, the trench warfare? How did you feel about that?
Well, you were sorry for the people below, but one felt that one had just as risky a job as they had.
I can understand that, but you had joined an infantry battalion. You were in an infantry battalion.
Yeah.
It was fate, whatever you want to call it, that, you know, you understand that you could apply for the Corps.
Yeah.
Did you not envision yourself down there in the trenches?
Well, no, I think you just simply said, well, how lucky I am to be up here instead of down there.
Fair enough, sir. Is it true that the Corps had, you were able to sleep on sheets? This is the big...
Yes, you could always get back at night, you see.
You had a bed and sheets.
If you got back, you had bed and sheets. And furthermore, if you were in a fighter squadron, you got leave every 3 months, which was a great thing. In other words, the powers that be realized there is no good keeping you 6 months in the line when you break up altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Much better to give you a rest after 3 months, and you'd come back again. And so that was a great thing, every 3 months to have leave.
Fabulous.
Yeah.
Now, during your training, now you passed this exam, or did you pass the exam?
Oh, yes, because I didn't go back to the infantry. But I was going to finish off the exam thing. When the exam finally came, everybody was naturally nervous, you know, to make sure that they passed the thing. There were 10 questions, and a child could have answered the questions. All they wanted was for you to sweat away and learn as much as you could, but they didn't want to plow you, you see.
Oh, those rotten guys, you're kidding. Oh, that's funny.
Well, that was clever, you know, when you think of it.
I guess it was.
Oh, yes, it was clever. They didn't want to lose anybody.
No.
who got that far.
Well, then where would you go for your flight training after this?
Well, then, after that, I went to Northolt, which is near Harrow, just out of London.
Mm-hmm.
And that
lovely
is...
Lovely around there. I was there in the summer. That's lovely around there.
Yes.
Beautiful country.
Well, Northolt, you know, it still operated there as an aerodrome, but it wasn't... It was all grass then. You see, there were no tarmac or anything like that. And you did your elementary training there, initial training, on these Morris Farman Shorthorn planes that they say if you put a bird in between the wings that it'd never get out because of the wires, hundreds of wires. Well, they were great planes. And well, then from there, then I went, I think I told you, to London Coney, just out of London, near St. Albans.
This is after you'd have your wings, is that correct then?
No, you hadn't got your wings by that time.
This is just what, elementary flyer
you'd
training?
You'd done your elementary flying on these Morris Farmans, then went to St. Albans where you flew an Avro two-seater. Lovely plane to fly. And when you'd mastered the Avro, which had a rotary engine. You see, there was no throttle. It was just you switch the engine on or you switch it off. As you were coming to land, you'd switch it off.